Well, it's that time of year where travel can be a little complicated. Welcome into World Changers for this week. I'm Jamie Osborne. Welcome our listeners on the BizTalk Radio Network, our TV audience on the Biz TV Network, and our digital audience on iHeartRadio. I had to go somewhere the other day. I had a meeting in Chicago, and I showed up to the airport, dark 30 in the morning like I was supposed to. They said, oh, there might be a problem with your flight. But, you know, I looked at my watch. It's not to worry. I've got a little extra time. So flight was canceled four times. They couldn't put me on another flight for whatever reason. I finally ended up going home. I missed a meeting in Chicago and all that kind of stuff. But it seems like the price of air travel isn't really coming down any, but the service level always comes down. We have to pay for our bags now. It's, oh, you wanted peanuts, you know, it's another $5 and all that kind of stuff. Well, there's some people recently who had a particularly awful experience, and here's what happened. So it was on a United Airlines flight. They took off from New Jersey. They were on their way to Hong Kong when there was a medical emergency. And so the plane was diverted to the Goose Bay Airport, which is in Newfoundland, Canada, and this is about 9 p.m. So they deal with the medical emergency. The plane's getting ready to take off again. The people are ready to be back on their way to Hong Kong when there's a mechanical issue that grounded the flight. But it gets better, okay? So first they come back on. They say, you know, there's been a mechanical issue. We're going to be delayed, et cetera, et cetera. But these U.S. passengers on their way to Hong Kong, of course, were now in Canada. And at this little airport in Canada, there was no customs officer or immigration officer on duty because it was past the time for that at this point. So these people couldn't get off the plane. And it gets worse from there. Not only could they not get off this plane, but there was apparently the mechanical issue was that there was something wrong with the door, and the door wouldn't close, and it the temperature was in the negative 20s, and so the inside of the cabin, got incredibly cold. These people were stuck on there 14 hours, stuck on the tarmac in this plane that wouldn't work in a country where they couldn't get off the plane, and they ran out of food and all that, so That's worse than my story. If you think you've had a bad airline experience recently, I'll bet you probably can't top that one. A woman was recently sentenced to 15 years in federal prison after admitting that the millions she spent on luxury vacations, cars, restaurants, and high-end shops came from, guess what, a fraudulent scheme. So here's what happened. She went out and she solicited investors to invest in a business that would provide software to physicians so that the physicians could engage in telemedicine, which is all the rage now, right? Instead of going to the doctor's office, if you have a sinus infection, you dial up your doctor, you chat about it, and poof, you know, a prescription finds its way to the pharmacy. And so what she told these people was that she needed more money to spend on the software to pay taxes and fees and development costs and that kind of stuff. Now, the software itself only cost $300,000. Apparently, she did buy the software, but she kept raising money. And she kept raising money, apparently, over the course of 4 years. Eventually, she got $5.4 million from investors, and some people apparently lost their life savings. They lost their houses. Whole time she was actually living it up in the Bahamas, sending messages talking about the four butlers that she had in her cabana in the Bahamas. Now she is been sentenced to be behind bars in federal prison. Well, speaking of the Bahamas and speaking of warmer climates, a man was kicked off a cruise ship recently for less than unusual reasons. His name is Nick Nadev. He was on a Royal Caribbean cruise, but he's now actually banned from the cruise line. You can get banned because for whatever reason, he decided to jump from a balcony on the 11th deck, the 11th story, if you will, the 11th deck on this Royal Caribbean cruise into the bay below. Not really a smart move because the bay below apparently were shark infested waters. They got him out before he became a shark snack. And he told Inside Edition this. He said, "I hope I don't inspire anybody to do this because it is very dangerous. I mean, don't think this is a joke." And apparently, according to the report, he had been drinking, or as they say, alcohol was a factor in that particular incident. All right, enough of my random stories. Let's go to the phones now. We have Colin calling from San Diego. Hi, Colin.
Hello, is this Jamie?
Yeah. So what's on your mind, Colin?
Hey, Jamie, I'm calling in about this Nick Nadev character, the one with the cruise ship.
Oh, okay. Have you ever been on a cruise before?
When I heard this story, I had to look it up right away. I couldn't even believe there was a video of it, because this is just out of this world. I mean, you see him, he's up there on the 11th story almost. It looks even higher than that in the video, but the fact that he didn't get injured is just incredible. You know, jumping from that kind of height and hitting the water, that's got to feel like concrete. So he must have just got lucky there was a wave or something, but wow.
Well, so it said apparently he had been drinking. You know, it's been my experience that if people have consumed enough alcohol, they can manage to do all sorts of superhuman feats and not get injured for whatever reason, or at least I don't feel it for a while after that. Have you ever been on a cruise ship, Colin?
Yeah, I have before, and you know, I guess that is a factor when you're drinking. You got to be careful near the edge, but to kind of see this guy so blatantly just get up on the rail and jump, that's just something else, you know?
One of the things I was kind of wondering, though, I was watching a segment on one of the cable networks the other day about cruises, and several of the major cruise lines are actually reporting that revenue is up right now. This is kind of despite the fact that most of the reporting has been that millennials aren't really into cruising, that they see it as being something for old people like me. What age group are you in, Colin?
I'm in the 20 to 30 age group, so I guess I'd be considered the younger crowd still.
So among you and your peers, is when you're thinking about vacations and things like that, I'm just kind of curious, how does cruising rank in your list of to-dos?
I think that the issue with cruising is that, you know, you got to pay the whole package, right? It's a real big upfront cost where, you know, if you're just going to go with your friends on a little spring break, you can kind of pick and choose what the hotel's going to be or how much you're going to stay for. The cruise, you got to pay like $1,000 or so right off the bat. And I mean, that includes a lot with food and stuff, but I think it's just a big commitment when you got a lot of people you're trying to plan with.
That's kind of interesting. So, you know, for my generation, at least, we kind of looked at the all-inclusive, you know, one-size-fits-all, pay-one-price, do-everything as a good thing. But for you, you're saying you want more flexibility. You want to put your dollars where you want to put your dollars. Is that right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, it depends on the group you're going with. If everyone's really well endowed, then it should be no problem. But sometimes, you know, you got the guy who can only afford one case of beer for the whole trip, or the other guy who wants to go and do every crazy thing imaginable, like skydiving. And with the cruise, sometimes it's hard to get that kind of flexibility, where if you just kind of go out there pro bono by yourself, you can do what you want.
Well, that's interesting. So one of the things that cruise ships have tried to do in order to appeal to your generation is put crazier and crazier attractions on the cruise ships. So a few weeks ago, we had a story. I think it was also Royal Caribbean. I might be wrong, but it was one of the cruise lines that has installed the world's first roller coaster at sea.
Oh, wow.
And apparently part of the thing actually goes out off the ship because, of course, cruise ships aren't that terribly wide, really. You know, they're really long. They're not that wide. So it kind of goes out over the water and circles back around. We're seeing more things like some extreme sports at sea, different types of entertainment and things like that, because these people know they have a problem. If they can't appeal to your demographic, then eventually they'll go off the rails, because your generation is now larger than the boomer generation. And of course, the boomer generation is still very much their cash cow, their bread and butter, but But if they can't figure out a way to make this sort of activity appealing to your generation, they're, you know, in a decade or so, they're going to have a pretty big problem. So what would it take? We've got about 30 seconds. What would it take for you to sign up?
I mean, I guess another part of it, too, you know, you said revenues have been up. I think that the younger generation, you know, really cares about a lot of humanitarian issues and that. I think we'd like to see the workers treated a little bit better, paid a little bit more. I mean, I was looking into it a little bit. The average salary for one of these employees is only around $20,000. So, you know, when someone does something like that, like jumping off the cruise ship, you know, those are the people that got to go out and, you know, that changes their whole
fix
day.
It. So. All right, yeah. Calling for San Diego, World Changers. We'll be right back.
I was having too much fun.
Welcome back. It's segment two on World Changers this week, Biz Talk Radio. I'm Jamie Osborne. Glad you're with us. I don't know if you saw this story recently. It was pretty viral on social media. It was a story about a family in Ohio that built a snow fort, but it wasn't just any snow fort. It was a completely accessible snow fort for some kids who needed wheelchair accessibility and that sort of thing. And the brainchild behind that, one of the brainchildren behind that, I guess, I don't know for sure if it was his idea, it was the dad and the family. His name is Greg Eichhorn. He joins us now on World Changers from Ohio. Welcome, Greg. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. How are you?
Great. Let's get to the snow fort in a minute, but first let's talk a little bit about your family's backstory. So your wife's name is Katie, and the two of you have adopted 9 children, which is in and of itself pretty extraordinary, but these are not everyday kids. These are kids with some that each have some sort of special needs. So tell us about your journey. How did you arrive at this calling in life?
Yeah, sure. Well, before my wife and I were even married, we had decided that we wanted to build our family through adoption, just because of, you know, biblical principles that kind of followed those standards. You know, God says in James 1:27, take care of the widows and orphans in their distress. So we wanted to follow the Bible and kind of build our family through a biblical way. So we decided that we were going to only adopt. So, and then through that adoption process, we found that we were missing calls for healthy kids. And then kind of these leftover market of kids was the medical needs and special needs kids. That seemed to be our niche, and then we decided to take on our first son, Elijah, who is fully handicapped and terminally ill.
And so how many years ago was that?
That was, Elijah's 11 now. So, and again, like, yeah, he was terminally ill, but like through the power of just, you know, God's miraculous power, and then through the power of just love in general and the attention that he got. His spinal cord that was deteriorating stopped deteriorating, and he just started to do really well in our home. He's still a dependent care kid, but he's thriving with his health as much as he possibly can.
How long had you and Katie been married at that point when you adopted your first child?
When we adopted Elijah, I believe we had been married, well, I'll say we're going on 15 years now, so I guess it would have been 4 years into our marriage, and it took about a year to get licensed. So Elijah was adopted 11 years ago.
So, you know, I think a lot of people who have thought about adoption, I know my wife and I did, we originally planned to adopt. We were like you. Before we got married, we really talked about it. We thought, you know, we're going to adopt. We actually ended up then going away on a month-long honeymoon, and we got pregnant on our honeymoon, and we were off to the races at that point, which derailed a lot of our adoption plans at that point. But I think the number one emotion a lot of people feel when it comes to adoption is fear. They fear the unknown of it. You know, what am I really getting myself into? You know, what if it doesn't work out? What if I get my heart broken? All these sorts of things. How did you cope with that? How did you cope with the fear of it?
Sure. Yeah. And I think that there is a lot of fear. I mean, like every time a new kid comes into my home, there's always fears. I mean, like I had no medical background whatsoever. Like Katie's family, they kind of took care of special needs kids. She actually taught like adapted aquatics. So she was working with special and handicapped kids. I had no medical background. I hadn't known any medical or special needs kids my entire life. So there, for me, there was probably a lot of fear. But I mean, when it comes down to it, sometimes in order to get something positive out of life, you have to address fear. So, and in my case, I really felt like God gave me comfort in the situation and said, like, I just really felt like I was supposed to do it. I mean, but nothing good in life comes without a struggle. And I think that a lot of times that fear that people face initially is, I mean, it can be a really good thing. Fear can stop you from doing some really stupid stuff in life. But fear can also stop you from doing some really good stuff in life. And man, if I hadn't been able to work through that initial fear of getting Elijah, my life would look so differently and not as whole. I mean, the kid that Elijah is today, he's dependent care. So like people are like, oh, what does he offer? Elijah can offer me more than most of my other kids actually can because he's dependent care. So if the other ones are driving me crazy, I'm like, oh my goodness gracious, just holding him. Like, you know, I have regimented times that I hold him 3 times a week where it's just me and him, you know, me and my boy just sitting on my lap and him snuggling with me. And he gives me such a sense of peace, and it's almost a reset for my whole week. It's great.
So you referenced your faith earlier, and you know, the Bible says that we walk by faith, not by sight, right? And so...
Yes.
Often you know, as you experience, and we haven't really talked about all your other kids and all their particular needs, but as you navigate all of that, you're leaning on your faith. What do you do to nurture that?
Oh man, yeah. So in order to nurture that, I feel like it's priority to have a relationship with God, and that might look strange for some people, but for me, what that looks like. I mean, I go to church weekly, but that's just a really small part of it. The Bible talks about praying continuously, and praying to me just means talking with God, having dialogue with God, whether it's silently in my head, if I'm struggling with something, saying, God, please help me through this situation, which seems constantly for a knucklehead like me, or, you know, daily reading the Bible. So I have a goal, you know, it's a very small goal, but reading a chapter of Bible a day, and trying to listen to some worship music, just to honor God for giving me life and giving me each day. So that's kind of what that looks like for me. I mean, I have community that I meet with weekly, and we read books, not always Christian books, just really positive books that influence you, and surrounding yourself with good people.
All right, we're down to a minute. We're down to a minute. Tell us about this fort real quick. It got posted to Reddit, was upvoted 70,000 times, took off another social media. Tell us really quickly about the fort.
Yeah, so the fort was just it was just my family spending time together and me wanting to include all of my kids. So some of my kids are handicapped, and really it was very, very just part of everyday life. Hey, let's make the opening a little bit wider so some of the handicaps can get included. And that's really all the fort was, and it was news to me that it went viral when it did.
All right, Greg Eichhorn from Ohio, he and his wife Katie, changing the world one kid at a time. Thanks for being with us, Greg, and you're listening to World Changers on the Biz Talk Radio Network. Welcome back to World Changers. getting outdoors, that's a big deal these days. Hiking, biking, mountain climbing. You may have done that, but chances are you probably haven't done it to the extent of our next guest. His name is John Beatty, and he describes himself as an Everest climber, a global adventurer, an entrepreneur, an author, a humanitarian, and a keynote speaker. So his feat on Mount Everest landed him in the media on 60 Minutes, Weather Channel, and some other places, and we welcome him into World Changers now. How you doing, John?
Doing great, Austin. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
That's great. Austin's actually the producer. I'm Jamie, but I will send along your regards to him.
Doing great, Jamie. Thanks so much for having me on
the show. There we go. That's cool. So you've written some books, and I'm gonna read the titles here because they're kind of pretty good titles. 7 Steps to Leading from the Top, The Mini Manual for Becoming Super Awesome, and Climb On Success Strategies for Teens. So the first thing I want to know is, how do I become super awesome, John?
That is an awesome question. Best way to become super awesome is to become the most authentic and true to you version of you that you can be. As soon as you figure out who you really are and what your gifts are to the world and how you can best serve people and humanity or our planet, and you live in that and not what kind of you think you should do or what other people have kind of conditioned you to do or what your purpose should be. Once it's real for yourself, that's how you become super awesome.
Fair enough. So let's take a little trip to Mount Everest, shall we?
Let's do it.
Once upon a time, you decided you wanted to tackle Mount Everest, but tell me about your journey to get there. Where did you start, and how did you kind of modulate up to making it to Mount Everest?
I started as a scared, acne-covered 13-year-old that got involuntarily signed up to go to Boy Scout camp. And yeah. I had never done any outdoor adventures. I wasn't raised in a particularly adventurous family, but there was a rock climbing and rappelling section that hit my life at the very right moment when I needed a challenge and a confidence builder and some people who really cared for me and for my growth. And I found all that with that specific camp and the scouts. That started my climbing adventure. I read the book Into Thin Air a little bit, I think it was a year or two after learning how to rock climb. And most people read that book and think, I don't ever want to do that. Well, I was kind of the opposite. I said, I really want to go do that. So I committed to climbing Everest when I was about 15 or 16 years old. It wasn't until I was 31 that I actually went to the mountain for the first time. And in between those years was mountaineering all over the world. I've climbed hundreds of mountains, many of which at that time were part of the 7 summits, the tallest mountain on every continent. I've now finished that accomplishment, but it wasn't like, I'm just going to go climb Mount Everest and then show up to the mountain. That's a dangerous thing that I don't recommend anybody does. I was well prepared by the time I went.
So I got to ask you, a while back I was speaking, and during the course of my presentation, I was talking about mountaintop experiences. Now, you've climbed hundreds of mountains. You've climbed the tallest mountain on every continent now at this point in your life. What's the greatest mountaintop experience for you so far?
The greatest experience was not the hardest feat. It wasn't the most acclaimed or media-covered climb where I was the hero. In fact, it was when I was on Mount Kilimanjaro with my father. And that, to me, was the greatest mountaintop experience because that's where my definition of success changed. It was about the team that I went with, the people who I was a part of and how I was living this expedition. And it shifted my understanding of what it really is to have a mountaintop experience.
So you, one of the things you are, in addition to being John the Global Adventurer, is you are an entrepreneur. And And it looks like you've done a pretty good job of taking your Everest experience and maximizing that as best you can to further not only your entrepreneurial endeavors, but also your personal brand and that sort of thing. And so you're a professional speaker, speaking among other things on how to develop Everest toughness. And I'm sure before you developed that talk and you got into that, you spent quite a bit of time thinking about what's missing. You know, what can I contribute and what can I present on that people want to hear about? And so you're talking about toughness at a time in our culture where that word isn't always celebrated right now, right?
I take a different approach to toughness as modern culture looks at it. I don't think that it's gritting. I don't think it's mowing over people and like gritting through the storm and just plowing through. My approach to toughness is much different. Mine is, if you're on a mountaintop and there are huge storms, or if you're in the middle of the ocean and there's 40-foot overhead swell, you need to be able to be at peace and be calm and be present in those moments. So I don't think you can go through a 2-month-long expedition, as is Mount Everest, climbing to the world's tallest peaks, or whatever the tallest peaks are in your life, just by trying to grit it out and tough it out and be the strongest person there is who doesn't need anybody. That's exhausting. Instead, it's about being in every single moment, being at peace, being filled with joy. And if you can arrive at that place, which is what I teach in my keynote speeches, you'll be able to last and endure longer than anybody who's just trying to muscle through it.
So when I asked you about your journey, you said you started off as a pimply-faced teenager, accidentally found yourself at scout camp, you know, stumbling into some adventure activity and you liked it. You wrote a book called Climb On Success Strategies for Teens. What do you say to teenagers?
To teenagers, my message is to become really clear about what you want for your life. That's essentially picking your summit. That's setting your goal. The next step is to make a plan to go achieve it. So when I pick the mountain that I'm going to go up on any specific day or any specific expedition, my next step is to create a roadmap or an expedition plan in order to get up that mountain. So for teenagers, it's whatever their mountain is, it's to have a clear path, including mentors and guides who will help to get you to the top. The last part of this climb on success formula that I teach teenagers is to go for it. I give them a real kind of kick in the pants and say, now's your time. Get after it. Climb on. Make this climb yours. Be here now. Give it absolutely everything you've got. And that sequence of picking your summit, gearing up or making your plan, and then climbing on, that's helped over 500,000 teenagers across the country that I've had the pleasure of being able to speak to live.
One of the things I often tell teenagers is that, you know, part of our instinct, I think, is to wait, you know, to think, I will do this, or I'll try to accomplish this at some point in the future. You know, maybe I'll wait and try that, you know, after college, or after I get married, or after I have kids, or after I've made some money, or things like that. And it sounds like your message is, you know, if you have a dream that's been planted somewhere in your heart, to get on with it and you know, go for it now, as opposed to kicking the can, you know, down the line. Would that be accurate?
That's 100% accurate. And you, those examples you listed off are absolutely right. All throughout life, we think, oh, the timing is going to be better later. When I was a teenager, I'll go talk to that girl when my zits go away. You know, like I'll be able to write a book once I graduate from college, or I'll be able to do this or that once I'm married, or once I have a house, or once eventually you're dead and you don't have any more onces. So it's absolutely right that teenagers, college students, even adults like you and I, we need to be in the now. We need to act on what our dreams and our passions are absolutely right now.
Well, John Beattie, who author of several books, professional speaker, How to Develop Everest Toughness, and a world-class global adventurer. We thank you for being on the show today, John, and can't wait to see what your next adventure is.
Thank you, Jamie, for having me on. I appreciate you very much. Take care and climb on.
Climb on indeed. Well, you're listening to World Changers on the Biz Talk Radio Network. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, you know, I don't know about where you work, but when the internet goes down at our office, the world stops spinning. Literally, we can't seem to accomplish anything. And that's, I think, the case more and more for people all around the world, not just in the developed world, but literally all around the world. Well, welcome back to World Changers, by the way. I'm Jamie Osborne. We're in our final segment today. And, you know, not all heroes wear capes, we like to say. And there are people out there who are working every single day to try to stop incoming threats to us online and to our companies that endanger our privacy, our livelihood, and that sort of thing. There are also people out there trying to work for the cause of freedom for countries that are increasingly using the internet and the access to it as a means to control people. You know, back in the day, when governments wanted to control the population, all they had to do was control the media. And they just had to, you know, make sure they control the media, and they make sure what people heard and make sure what kids learn in school and things like that. The internet, of course, opened up the world and made controlling people a lot more difficult. And so in some cases today, we have governments that are actually shutting down access to the internet. If you've been following the news, this has happened recently in Zimbabwe. This has happened recently in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where they just had a very controversial election that had been delayed quite a bit, and there was a lot of unrest after that. Well, one of these heroes without a cape is named Christopher Kennedy. He is with a company called Attack IQ Cybersecurity. He joins us from Connecticut. And welcome to World Changers, Christopher.
Hi, Jamie. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you're very welcome. I'm not sure I want to know the answer to this question. I'm going to ask it anyway, because sometimes in life, Christopher, it's better to be blissfully unaware of things than it is to be too aware. Because the more we're aware, you know, I wouldn't want to be in the White House and be in on those national security briefings every day, because I'd probably be afraid to go outside for the rest of my life if I really knew that. But when you talk about a field like cybersecurity and you look at all the things that are going on out there, all the different kinds of threats that are going on, what would the average person out there be surprised to learn, do you think?
Well, Jamie, I think it's really important to kind of step back and just think about how we got here to begin with. The internet was born as a DARPA research project for research scientists to exchange ideas, and was quickly monetized in the late 90s and early 2000s to create the dot-com bubble and all this newfound revenue for emerging nations using the internet as a way to conduct e-commerce. And then from that, what we realized is that the internet was born fundamentally from insecure protocol. And that's where the security industry has evolved from. And because of the global dependence on the internet for communications, for conducting commerce, and now for critical infrastructure, I think that the average person would be surprised to understand both the fragility of the internet and the security underpinning security protocols that that make it difficult to secure, and the immaturity of that. And they would also be surprised to understand how much of the world revolves around use of the internet and the risks of critical infrastructure, financial services, and things like that, that the heroes without capes are dealing with every day. The money in your account, the water you drink, the electricity you derive, and the logistics train that delivers food to your grocery store every day, all are connected in some way to a system that's riding on the internet today.
So we, at some level, I think we know that to be true, that you know, the electric grid, for instance, all these sorts of things are fragile due to their interconnectivity via the internet. This is one of those areas where you've got the government involved. You know, you certainly have cybersecurity professionals inside the government, that corporations that are engaging in cybersecurity. Where do you see it going from here? You know, I mean, at what point do we get a handle, or do we?
You know, that's a great question, Jamie. I've been doing this for 20 years. I cut my teeth in military service doing computer network defense functions, spent some time in defense industrial-based contractors, and got to participate both in what it means to do offensive and defensive cybersecurity functionalities for national-level organizations. I spent some time in financial services and now with Attack IQ. And what we're trying to do in the continuous security validation space. Where's it? With every raising of the bar, with every investment in security, given the global connectivity and the avenue of approach that the internet provides today, there will be a new threat actor, a new emergent way to exploit. And that's what is driving and fueling the security industry. What I think is interesting, and the way you have to think about it in terms of what it means for the world, what it means for emerging nations, what it means for businesses, is you have to think about business continuity plans. You have to think about, what would we do if this thing that I rely on the internet for goes away, and what would it mean for our business? You can no longer think of it just being a telephone jack and it's always going to work. Second order, you have to be more security thoughtful in the things that you do and the assumptions that you would historically make around use of the internet. And I think, you know, where I want to take the industry and my role at Attack IQ is that there's an entire burgeoning industry of security functionalities out there that are pervasively trying to raise the bar. And in trying to raise the bar, you don't even know if the thing that you're doing is actually working. And so always having a system of checks and balances in place and a method for validating the security you think you have actually works is really important.
Well, it's just a matter of trying to stay one step ahead of the bad guys, I imagine, because it's kind of like, if you've ever tried to keep a mouse out of your house, you plug one hole and guess what? Mr. Mouse will find another way in. Christopher Kennedy is with
Attack IQ. We need to build a better match.
That's right. Attack IQ Cybersecurity. Look them up online. I'm Jamie Osborne. Thanks for being with us this week on World Changers. We'll see you right back here next week.